It's not how you start, it's how you finish. Hello, everybody. This is Jake Senzan. I host Jake and Gino podcast here with my co-host, the multifamily mentor, the coach, the chef, the father, six, the best-selling author, the G-Daddy, Gino Barbaro. Gino, how's it going?
Jake, I'm doing very good today. How you doing, my friend?
Always making it happen, big man. Today's guest is the author of Modern Leader and CEO of a multi-million dollar publishing company that was recently ranked numero uno, number one top company culture in America by Entrepreneur Magazine. That's no small feat, but it wasn't always this way. He speaks openly about his upbringing from poverty, abuse, and discrimination. So how did he come from nothing to having it all? And apparently he looks like The Rock. You know, we just found out that today. So there's a lot of good coming out of this. But most importantly, what lessons can be learned from his journey? So without further ado, Javon McCormick, welcome to the show.
Gentlemen, what's going on? That was a hell of an introduction. Thank you, sir.
Hey, you know, when we bring special folks on, we got to bring the pain. So here, we got to start with the award, though. So yeah. What did it take to earn that number one spot for top company culture in America? That's phenomenal.
Man, that's all the people that I get to serve and support. The awesome thing about
and you're talking about your team members.
The team members, man.
Because don't get it confused with the customers.
Yeah, don't get it confused with the customers. It's the big thing, man, I said this, if I could back up a little bit, what last November, I was named the best CEO in Austin. And then this last June, I was named Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year. And what I find interesting is, so I go up, receive the award, all the good stuff. And I say this openly and publicly, I personally feel we put CEOs on a pedestal. And I don't quite understand why. If you really look at it, I don't do the work. All the people that I serve and support execute on the day-to-day. So I don't understand why the CEOs are always celebrated and put on these pedestals to win these awards. We're truly only as good as the great people we get to serve and support. So back to your original question, how did we win? Man, it's by way of the team.
I'm going to push back on that a little, Javon, because you can say the same thing about basketball teams, right? I mean, you have Jordan, but Phil Jackson got them to play together. So there is a special place in what you do. And we're going to just be discussing leadership, and especially now in this day and age, to find people who want to play on your team and to be able to lead those people, I think is truly important. So I do agree that they do get a lot of the credit, but it's very difficult nowadays.
Bill Belichick is still winning games without Tom Brady, my friend. All right, you got to remember that.
You know, that's a very fair point. And you know, when you said that, it's harder now than ever. And I really appreciate you bringing it up. Think about this for a moment. So if you take Warren Buffett, who just turned 92, and you take the 22-year-old startup founder. So we got a lot of years in between there. Here's
a lot of Coca-Cola's in between there too.
Oh man,
how's
a lot of
he still kicking, man?
Hey, and I mean, in like, I love his partner Charlie Munger. Charlie Munger's like 98 and still comes to the quarterly meetings, says whatever the hell he wants. I love Charlie, but what's interesting? Take a look at that. Warren Buffett 92, startup founder 22. A lot of years in between there, but here's what's key. No CEO, no leader walking the earth right now has ever dealt with all that we're going through at once. You look at Warren Buffett. Yeah, he has seen racial tension. He has seen the Vietnam War. He's seen inflation at 17% interest rates, the Great Recession. He's seen Roe versus Wade come and go, but none of us have seen all of it at once. We've got the virus. We've got racial tension, diversity, equity, and inclusion. We've got transgender. We've got the supply chain, interest rates, work from home, all of these things we've never encountered all at once. So for me, what you're seeing is you're seeing a lot of the quote, what I call the quote unquote fake ass playbook leaders, where they've always just run a playbook. It doesn't work anymore. And they're like, wait a minute, there's no pages in here for this. So now they're kind of scrambling.
The 60s to the 70s, though, I think, you know, it may have been a longer time span, but I think it probably included a lot of that you're discussing. It's just probably transferred a lot quicker due to the internet now.
It transferred a lot quicker, and I would say this as well. You never saw. Here's the best way I can say this. You all know this. I was born in 71. My dad was black. My mother was white. So I'll be the first one to tell you, growing up mixed race in the 70s, oh, not a good look. You know, black people didn't like you because you were half white. White people didn't like you.
You couldn't find a place.
Exactly. You were always trying to fit in, be well, you know, you were always trying to belong, be accepted. But what's interesting about that, man, is you make a phenomenal point there, but we didn't have what I would say some of the coming together that we do now. Now you have a big divide where back then it was still kind of, you know, separate. You were still dealing with affirmative action. Things were taking place.
Because wouldn't it have been harder for you then than now?
Hell like yeah.
That, I guess that's what I'm saying. So like the there might be more challenges, but they may have been deeper back then.
Yeah, deeper, and I would say this as well, with the racial piece of it now, what I find more complicated is people don't know how to approach it. You know, it's what did people always say in the workplace? Don't talk about politics and religion. Well, now we're starting to talk about diversity, race, transgender, gay, and some people are very nervous because in business, you always left that shit at the door. You know, you keep your personal stuff at the door, come in here, do your job, get out. Well, that's not the world we live in anymore.
Wow.
Why is that?
I feel that
generational shift.
It's not only generational. Here's something else that I don't know that people paid attention to as well. Unions in our country were at their height back in the 40s and 50s. People had got fed up on how companies were treating them. They would, you know, they were just, you know, do your job, get out of here. They didn't care. Well, then what happened is you saw a shift in corporate America where companies started treating people better. Then they put in pension plans, they put in benefits, things of that nature. So things got good for a while. But then in 2008, my opinion, things started to shift when you saw the Great Recession, and now pensions were taken away. Mm. Benefits started being cut. Well, here we are in 2022 where people are like, this is bullshit. Companies aren't taking care of us. And what do you see now? The rise of unions again. I mean, people are trying to unionize at Starbucks, the Apple store. I mean, places you would have never... 5 years ago, Starbucks was like celebrated for being such a great place to work and 401k and benefits. Now they're unionizing.
Do you mind if I share my opinion about this real quick?
Hell no.
Gino, it's your show.
It's your show, man.
I'm just taking all of this in. No, listen, I'm taking all this in. And I think for me, from being a father of six, and the family is gone by the wayside. And this is the biggest component to me. If you have a family and you have a dad, you don't need a company helping you out and giving you guidance. You have the family, and the company is what you want to do, how you want to create impact. It's reversed now. And when there's no father at home, and there's no mother at home, and there's no leader at home to take your cues and to be able to grow up and to have the self-esteem and the support, because I was poor too. Both my parents are immigrants, but that kind of poverty 50, 60, 70 years ago is different than the kind of poverty today. Yeah. They were able to go somewhere else. They were able to go down the street and get a piece of bread or get some lentils because they had that support. People don't have that support now. And that's the dissolution. Back in the 60s, 75% of African Americans were born in wedlock. It's reversed now.
Yeah.
That's the issue. That to me, as a white person, that's how I see it. I see it from that lens. And you can look at, you know, single parent, you look at poverty and all that, it's based upon that. I'm not saying that people who live in single parent households can't do well, but it's stacked up.
It's a lot harder though. You have half the resources that you wouldn't in a dual, you know, just because it's look, either someone's watching the kids or someone's earning, or two people are earning and someone else is, they're paying for it, right?
So, and this is
it's a resource issue at the, you know, the root of it.
This is one of the reasons why we created Jake and Gino. I wanted to create a company of culture to show that my employees are part of a family, to show that my kids, that we can grow a company based on those values and create impact, and having students in our community that gravitate towards what we're trying to do. We're trying to promote the family, trying to have spouses work together. I work with my wife in the company. She does a podcast with me, and to show kids that that work can be fun. You know, we're grown up that work, you got to go put in 40 hours. We got to work for the man or work for the woman, but that's not what work should be. Work should be invigorating. Work should be hard. We're scared to work nowadays. And I want my kids to see that work can be hard, but it can be fun also. And we can leave an impact. So, I mean, that's my two cents on the soapbox.
No, I think that's very fair. The key to that, while I don't disagree, and you got to remember, I'm one of those kids in 71 that came from the broken home who, you know, mom was a prostitute, dad was a pimp, you know, so that there was no lessons coming to the house, if you will. Where I feel that we fall short right now as well is no child asked to be born. Like, mm-hmm. I didn't ask to be born to a pimp father and a prostitute mother. Mm-hmm. Where we are falling short right now as a society is you have a good piece that you're saying there is we're no longer a community. So what's happening mm-hmm. is these kids are being left to the wayside to fend for themselves and try to figure all this shit out. And there's no one there teaching, coaching, mentoring.
No, there are, but it can be the wrong people, right? You can run into people that are dealing drugs, and then you get a sense of family and purpose and belonging. And then that pulls you into that crowd where, you know, the kid is searching for something, and that gives, you know, that fills that void. So that's where it really goes south.
John, you talked about it in our previous podcast that you were in the car with your dad driving around, and he's I mean, if you want to share that story, but I really want to know, how did you pull yourself out of that situation and be able to, you know, become CEO of a company, have a family, four kids? And to me, that's the American dream. How did you have that evolution from that point in the car with your dad? He's teaching you business and he's treating his customers well. I mean, his employees well. And I remember the story so vividly. And if you could share that with the listeners and then just share your evolution of how you pull yourself out of that.
Yeah, my first view to, you know, and I didn't even know what the word was, entrepreneurship was when I was 9 years old. I was out collecting money from prostitutes with my dad. I was sitting in the front seat, and we pull up to the first prostitute, and she sticks through the window this huge stack of money. And I remember it was cold outside, Dayton, Ohio. I can still smell the heater in the Cadillac. And she asked my dad, "Hey, can I come in? I made my count, you know, can I come in now?" And my dad, in the most loving, sweet voice, "Oh, girl, get back out there. You're on a roll. Keep it going. I'll come back around and you can pick where we go to dinner." Like that was a bonus.
Well, he said you can what?
"You can pick where we go to dinner."
Oh, wow.
So then we get to the next prostitute, and it looked like she slid through, you know, $3. And my dad lost it. He called her every foul, derogatory, nasty word you can think of. And she stood there crying, and he, you know, yelled at her, "Don't be common. Get your ass back out there." Rolled up the window and we drove off. And I remember right after we drove off thinking to myself, I wonder if I treated the prostitutes nicer, they got to keep part of the money. Could I make more money in volume because more of the prostitutes would want to work with me because I'm nicer and they get to keep part of the money? And so I started thinking about, how do you scale this? But then, you know, competition hit me. I was like, oh, I'm going to have a lot of pimps mad at me because I'm going to start taking their women. And that was really my first view into putting people first. How do you put people first? How, you know, entrepreneurship. So the lessons are out there. I will argue with anyone that some of your smartest business minds are in prison right now. And it's because they went down an illegal path. But if you look at some of the companies, and I say companies, businesses that they built and the intricacies of how it was built, you have some of the most gifted business minds.
Do you have any examples right that people would know?
I mean, you can take damn near any drug dealer at a high level and really look at, okay, what did they build in, you know, distribution, supply chain, follow up, follow through, collection.
You know, making sure you collect the money, right?
Exactly.
The collection's big, you know,
exactly.
And you have to, you know, these guys are hiding it too. So there's another layer of complexity there versus just being open about it, right?
You know, I don't know if we talked about this last time, but even think about this. first of all, back to your point about, you know, kids and them not having the examples. One, how am I supposed to aspire to become something when I don't even know what exists? And the great example I give of this is, what if I went out and I told a kid that was standing on the corner, sun up to sundown, that's a drug dealer, selling, you know, rocks all day, heroin, whatever it is. And every drug dealer knows the first rule is the first sample is free. Why? Because we want you to get hooked, because you'll keep coming back once you're hooked. Well, what if I went out and I told one of these kids, hey, I'm going to pay you six figures a year. I'm going to give you a company car. I'm going to give you a company phone, a company laptop. I'm going to give you an Amex expense account. And if you're really good at passing out free samples at the end of the year, I'm going to give you a huge bonus. I'm going to put you on stage. I'm going to celebrate you, and I'm going to give you a trophy. What if I told these kids that? These kids would say, what the hell is that? And I'd say, oh, that's a pharmaceutical rep. Pharmaceutical reps pass out free samples all day.
I was a high step rep back in the day.
See, you knew exactly
nothing
what
that
I
you said
about.
Is incorrect.
You knew exactly what I was.
And the parties were great. I mean, they bring you up there, you'd get your award, you had a trip and everything with it. And it was a hell of a party. So,
but how do, again, if it's sad, think about this right now, guys. If I'm a 5 to 17-year-old kid growing up in Chicago, Chicago has gotten so bad, we've nicknamed it Chirac. That's just sad. So if I'm a kid and I'm growing up in poverty, murders, shootings, drugs, where do I even learn that I can become a forest ranger? Now think about that. I'm not knocking a forest ranger, but the salary's not big. It starts at 40 grand a year. But what if I told this kid, you know, hey, you could be a forest ranger. And the kid looks at me, what the hell is that? Well, you get to work out in nature, fresh air, trees. What? Like that? Somebody's going to pay me to do that? Yeah. How? But where do I get to learn that even is a possibility?
Mm-hmm. It's another one that I tried to do. Didn't make the cut on that one. But, you know, you're really in tune with me right now. And it's funny too, because it is like last time I was in Chicago, the cab driver was like, no, you got to keep your windows up here. I'm like, why? He's like, we just don't want, you know, it helps with any bullets whizzing by kind of thing. And like, he was serious.
Yeah.
I was like, Jesus, dude.
That's a lack of leadership in these cities. I mean, first you have to stem the crime and then you have to figure out because it's not lack of money. We have so many resources, but it's lack of political will, the will to be able to do the job, to do the work. And I don't want to get away with the question that I asked you before, but how did you get out of that? I mean, you're 9 years old, you're getting wads of cash, you're living in that environment. How are you able to pull yourself, extricate yourself from those surroundings?
You know, I appreciate that, and work with me how I answer that. One of the greatest gifts that was given to me, and you heard me say again, how can I aspire to be something when I don't know what's possible? When my dad had decided to move the pimp game down to Houston, Texas, on one occasion, my dad was driving me through this ultra affluent, exclusive neighborhood called River Oaks. And in River Oaks, there were $5, $10, $25 million homes. I was 10 years old. I had never seen such a thing. These lawns were huge. These houses were massive. And one family lived in these homes. These homes were bigger than the projects I was growing up in. And I remember driving through that neighborhood. He didn't say anything. He could have been driving through the neighborhood for him. But for me, I remember seeing these homes and saying to myself, okay, I'm going to have one of those. I don't know how. I don't know how I'm going to get it, but I'm going to have one of those. What's key there? It showed me possibility. And in the beauty of how I was raised in, you know, U.S. poverty, because poverty in other countries is way different than the United States poverty. So, but poverty nonetheless here in this country. The beauty in this is I never was raised in middle-class America, because so many times you aspire to what you see. So if you're raised by a two-parent home and you're maybe both your parents went to college, maybe one just went to college, and maybe your mom works, your dad works, whatever, and you live in a three-bedroom, two-and-a-half-bath house, two-car garage, well, you aspire to what you see. Well, I came from shit. So all I saw was, oh, wait a minute, $25 million home. I'm skipping right over this middle class thing and I'm going over here because I see rich and wealth. There was nothing for me to aspire to but to be wealthy. And that was a massive key for me. And the last piece of this, I'll share this with you all to show you the power of it. So You know, in this country, we've weaponized the word privilege. We've now weaponized it and we use it against people. And what I find interesting about that is we're all after it. We all want a nice house. We all want better for our families. We all want better for ourselves, our children, whatever the case. We all want that privilege. But yet and still, we demonize the people who have it. Privilege is only a negative if you don't use your privilege to help elevate others. That's the only time it's negative. Because if you're using your privilege to help elevate others, then that's a good thing. So given how I was raised, yeah, crappy, but I have a hell of a privilege. I know things that most people in this country are never going to know about this country. So I have this deep responsibility to give back to these communities where I've come from. So here's the power of showing somebody what's possible. I got two of the kids that I mentored when they were coming through the juvenile halfway house. They were in juvenile prison. They were transitioning to the juvenile halfway house back into society. So I got to meet with them, teach them, coach them, and mentor them when they were at the halfway house. I arranged a field trip for them to come to the software company when I was the president of a software company here. And when they came in, some of these kids, it was the first time they had ever been on an elevator. And some of these kids, their highlight was how nice our wooden doors were on the restrooms. And I don't get me wrong, they were nice doors, but damn, that was their highlight, was wooden doors on the restrooms. Well, one kid took one of the software books, and then this kid graduated from the halfway house. I spoke at his high school graduation. He then went to community college. He then went and got his four-year degree. He got his degree in computer science. That kid right now here in Austin, he's about 28 years old, makes about $150,000 a year. He's got over 50 grand saved up in his 401k. Why? Because he got to see what was possible. That is such a critical piece for kids who never get to see what's possible.
I'm looking down here, and you mentioned the word privilege. Part of the problem with the privilege is that most people grow up today now being selfish. And when it's all about the self and it's not about God, you're focusing on yourself. And to me, it's another example for myself, my life. I'm privileged to be born in this country, to have two parents that had the wherewithal to move here and to create that privilege for me and to be able to grow up in this economy, but now trying to give back. If it was all about me, that's part of the problem. And that privilege, people don't understand that leaving an impact and thinking long-term. We always talk about that long-termism and thinking about what you want your legacy to be. Most people don't think about that. It's all about themselves. And I think that's part of the problem. That's another issue that we're having right now. We're getting away from faith and from things that are bigger than ourselves and just worrying about ourselves. So there's a lot of pieces to the puzzle. And as I see what's going on with the media and with all the other stuff that's going on, they're trying to separate us and trying to remove things that are sacred to what this country was founded upon, and making things black and white when they're not black and white. So
whoa, everything's black and white, because I'm black and white. That's how I see the world. Whoa, slow down. I do know gray areas. I only do black and white.
I love that. Your leadership, the new evolution of leadership. I mean, give us some ideas of, you know, what makes a good leader for you.
A person who truly puts people first. You know, I don't just say it. Again, you know, you guys know I got a GED, man. I never went to college. I got a GED. Not a lot going on up here. So I keep things very simple. People, process, profits. With those profits, do great things for the communities that we live and work in. I keep it very simple. Put people first. Great people can build great process, which make great profits. And then you do great things for the communities that you live and work in. Another thing that we've demonized in this country, capitalism, you know, profitability. Again, profitability is not bad. What's bad is what are you doing with the profits, or what are you not doing with the profits? If you're just sitting on a cash hoard, yeah, that's some greedy shit. That's when profitability is bad. But profitability enables us to pay for healthcare, enables us to pay for the matching 401k, the salaries, the increases. When we did an inflation increase, profitability allowed us to pay for those things. So profitability is not bad. It's if we're not doing for people with those profits where it's bad.
You know, what's worse than profitability?
What's that?
No profitability.
Man, it hurts me to say the word nonprofit.
Well, no, it's not even that. Well, nonprofit, it should be break even, right? Like going negative is very bad, and that's destruction and pain. So there, it's like two sides of the coin. And I think that, you know, so many people get caught up in these different movements or these things when you got to get down to brass tacks sometimes and say, hey, look, if you're making profit, it's because you're providing value for others. And if you're not, it's not going to sustain over time, and you will go out of business. And I think that's the thing that so many folks struggle with, and it's really freaking hard to do it over time. I know, you know, as these companies get bigger, like Apple and these pharmaceutical companies, it definitely changes. But I think for most small to medium sized businesses, it's a totally different conversation than once you're talking, you know, with these extremely large corporations. And I'm not even hating on the large corporations or anything, but it's two totally different worlds.
You know, the one piece that I would push back on some of these larger cash companies that are holding massive cash hoards is the person I would say that I admire most in business would be Milton Hershey, Hershey's Chocolate. And the reason being is that man created a whole town, a whole city. And furthermore, what he did that's the most impactful of a legacy piece is the Hershey School. 2,000 kids each year get to go to school. And these kids come from underprivileged communities. Some of them are orphans, and they live there. They learn family. They learn structure, routine, discipline. And it's 100% paid for. Healthcare, new shoes, new clothes, meals.
But it's that tie into community that you were talking about before, where the people are getting pissed now with the larger corporations is the influence. If you look at tech, if you look at these pharma companies, there's this weird merger with government that's going on now that maybe hasn't been there in years. And that could be, I don't know if the union, you know, component that you're talking about plays into that at all. But that's, to me, what's changed in the last, you know, like 5 or 10 years. And I think that's what people are starting to get resistant to, because it there doesn't seem to be that a separation of church and state.
Right.
And there seems to be a merger, and it's feeling a little weird almost, right?
Well think about what Hershey did. And just he set up an endowment that the profits that come from Hershey will continue to pay for the school. And each year there, you know, for those 2,000 kids, it costs about $300 million for the kids to go to school. Then let's say for the grounds and everything to go, throw in another $300 million. So $600 million a year goes to this school. Here's what I find interesting. Imagine this, there's a certain company that's a fruit. If they took that close to $200 billion cash hoard and they just took $20 billion of it, set it to the side, let it make basic interest.
A fruit that may be a tech company?
And maybe a tech company. But think about what they could do in serving kids, and then the legion of fans that they would have that went to school, received all the tech that they provide. And then, oh, I want to work here. So they put me through school. Now I want to work here. And think about the minimal cost it would be for them.
Plus, you'd have the products that people love, and then you'd have the community involvement that like people could really feel. That merger would almost make them, you know, indestructible, you know.
Like I said, man, Milton Hershey got it right. He ran an incredibly still profitable company, but he gave back and did things for the community. Milton Hershey is the definition of, my opinion, how business should perform.
Profit is the fuel. It is not the destination, and it's just the applause of your customers. Last question before we go to the personal growth segment. Walk us through your idea of why you wrote the book. We were joking around going through your process. Let's talk about the scribe process and how it was effortless for you, but, you know, a lot of work for your team members to put this book together.
Why? So what was the question? Why did I do the book?
Yeah. Why did you write the book? I mean, you're so, you know, got so much stuff going on. You're super successful, and
corporate America in the business world, we run on a broken playbook. And so take a look at this for a second, because it's not all race, but you've got some components to this that are deeply fractured. So we started tracking in this country in 1955. We started tracking the 500 largest companies in America in 1955. You did not have a Black CEO show up on that list until 1987, 30 plus years. And in even since 87, you've only had 14 that have been on the list. So what happened is we built a very exclusionary playbook for the working world. And if you did not fit the parameters of the playbook, you were not getting in. And that's a very limited view of where we are in our country. And like I said, you're seeing this right now where, okay, people are, you know, it's an uprising going on. Like, this is a broken system. And for me personally, where a big part of it came from was in the early 90s when I was trying to you know, further my career, because I at the time I was a mailboy in my early 20s. I didn't want to just be a file clerk the rest of my life. So you both will appreciate this. This is back when you had to work to get work. Like, you had to go take your resume somewhere. You had to go apply. You had to make cold calls. Like, you had to work to get work. And so I could not get an invite. I couldn't get a call back. I couldn't get on anyone's calendar. And so one day, a nice white guy picks up the phone and he says, "Hey, how did you get a black first name, Javon, and an Irish last name, McCormick?" "Well, man, I don't know where my last name comes from. My mother got our last name in the orphanage." And so all I did was focus on, holy shit, my last name's Irish. This is amazing. But when I hung up the call, it hit me. I was like, oh, they're seeing Javon. That's why I'm not getting called back. So my full name's Javon Thomas McCormick. And so I made the choice. I edited myself and I said, I'm going to go by JT McCormick. And the next week, guys.
Sounds like an author.
Oh, man. Yeah. There's a guy that did a book. Yeah. So the next week, man, callbacks, appointments, it just lit up. And I can't tell you how many times I walked into someone's office and they said, JT McCormick. And I said, yes. Oh, you're not who we expected. And so, you know, my whole career was built on JT McCormick. And then the George Floyd murder happened. And man, I was so disgusted by the virtue signaling shit that I was seeing. Blackout Tuesday on social media. Like, what the hell does that do? We were arguing over a syrup bottle. Guys, a syrup bottle. Like, what is that?
Can you define virtue signaling? Because I've heard this recently, and I don't think many people actually understand what it is.
Virtue signaling is when you do something either because, in my opinion, that you don't want to get called out for not doing it, or you're doing it just as a signal to show, oh, look, we care as well. We're involved. And when you had Blackout Tuesday on social media, you had so many people, so many companies, they didn't give a damn about what was going on. They just didn't want to get called out for not doing it. Here's another virtue signaling for me. I know we all remember the nine black people who got shot while they were praying at a Bible study in church in South Carolina. The white kid came in, shot the churchgoers. And what I found interesting is shortly thereafter, the governor announced that they were going to take the Confederate flag down off of the Capitol. Now, one can't say that if the Confederate flag was already down, that would not have happened. You can't sit there and make that connection. But what I found interesting is, why not? We are a very reactive country. Why not pull the Confederate flag down before someone gets shot? So for me, that was a definition of virtue signaling. Oh, look, we support that. This can't happen. Let us take the flag down. So I call bullshit on that. Even this, guys, I'll own it. The black guy here on the podcast. All of the statues and pulling the statues down and all that bullshit. Here's the fact of the matter. That's history. It happened. Now, I'm not saying that those statues should be, you know, on display in the middle of the public town square, but they should still go to the museum or you know, somewhere, because it's history. You know, people should know. You can't erase history, because if you try to, it will just repeat itself.
Actually, so they are trying to erase history. That's the exactly problem. I mean, you want to get rid of Abraham Lincoln for all his faults? I think he did a pretty good job. Probably one of the best presidents ever. I mean, Robert E. Lee didn't agree with him. He was a leader, but he was an amazing general. We can learn about these things. Don't get rid of them. Let's see how bad they were. And let's take history in its context of how, you know, talk about Columbus back in the 1400s. I heard a segment on Bill Maher. Back in the 1400s, everyone was atrocious. And not just Columbus, the Mayan, I mean, everybody was. So let's take history in its context. Let's understand what happened back then, and let's try to learn from it and try to get better from it instead of saying, pushing it aside and trying to rewrite things. And that's what I have an issue with all that stuff.
It's almost like childish, because you have like anger and frustration. You're acting extremely emotional. So you want to destroy stuff and tear things down out of rage and emotion. And I don't know that that's healthy either. And versus acknowledging the imperfectness of things when, okay, so, because here's the thing. Some of those people that they tore down or whatever, right? Whatever the case may be.
They're awful. There's
possibilities that those people did good things, but maybe they had bad parts of their life too, right? Like, I don't know. I mean, I don't really know exactly who's been torn down and what, but I mean, if there's a statue, there's a reason there's a statue, you know, for putting that person up. They did something that people applauded at one point, but maybe they had slaves or something. And I'm not saying that's a slight or something to look over, but throughout history, there's been a lot of slaves that have been owned by other people. So I think it's you know, making sure that people can have the discussion and talk about it versus the rage and emotion, because I don't think that's healthy either.
Well, you know, and that's the part what we aren't doing in our country is willing to have those open conversations about what happened, what didn't happen. Even this, I'll mess with you here.
Yeah. It's reactionary and emotional.
Yes. And like I said, we're a very reactionary country. But right now, you know, Columbus Day is coming up. And so my four children go to private Christian school, because I do agree with you on the family and the values and things of that nature. And so my four children go to private Christian school. So one of the kids comes home with some Columbus piece of material. And I was like, who's that? And they said, Columbus, he discovered America. I'm like, didn't. No. And I said, we're writing this back to the teachers. Like, what do you mean, Dad? I go, you can't discover something when there's people already there. I go, that's like us walking next door to the neighbor's house, knocking on the door and say, hey, we just discovered your house, get out. Mm-hmm. And I go, no, he did not discover America, guys. That's it. So needless to say, I got a call. And so, but I stood by it. And from what it looks like, they may pull that out of it, because I'm like, that's bullshit. Stop teaching things that just aren't true.
But I'll push back on that too, because someone did go from that continent to this continent, right? And so that is, like, you know, looking at it, like, say it was Columbus, or you could say it was, you know, Dalt. What are these guys called? The Vikings?
Leif Erikson,
whoever the hell it was, right? That's still a significant voyage and trek and accomplishment to go from, at that time, to just blind faith, shoot out there and go all the way across the ocean, right?
Hey, so I give love to the fact of, like you said, like, yeah, that's a hell of a trek to make to come over here.
Yeah.
But if we're calling that what it is, Christopher Columbus was Italian, correct?
Some people want to believe that. Like, you know, right, there's also people that say it's not. Like, you know,
So who, wherever he came from,
I'm just, and the reason I'm posing this, because I was on a conversation with somebody last week that said, no, Columbus wasn't Italian. Like, all right, I'm just not.
Okay. So whatever he was and wherever he came from, that should be the place of celebration for Christopher Columbus, not here. Yes.
I think you're right about that. Like, people see the world as they are, not as it is. I was looking at it from the other perspective, but I can definitely see it from your perspective. We as Italians want to celebrate somebody who got in a ship 500-600 years ago, almost got his ass mutinied. The fact that he had the faith and the skill to get over here should be challenged. I mean, that's about the American spirit. And if you want to say, oh, well, this is what, you know, this country was sort of founded upon its freedom and trying to take those big risks. Okay, but I agree with you on the fact that
and none of this shit is easy, because look at the three of us privileged guys right now, right? Let's call it, we're all, you know, very well off to do, you know, financially, have, you know, the nice families and everything. And we're here in this country, you know, and probably none of our ancestors, you know, I'm not going to go Elizabeth Warren. I have a little bit of, you know, Native American history, but I'm not going to go like there. But, you know, probably came over from somewhere else, right? For the most part. So it's, I don't know, man. It's just, it's, nothing's easy. And I think a lot of people just either get emotional and try to politicize things, or just don't talk about it. And that's, you know, where you're at, you know?
I'll shut up after this, guys, but you just nailed something for me.
Yeah.
I look in right now, there's a family, there's a single mom walking with two kids, an 8-year-old and a 6-year-old. 1,100 miles from Honduras, and they're walking 1,100 miles, and they're standing at the U.S. border right now, and they made it to the river, and they're looking at this river, and this mom doesn't know how to swim. Kids don't know how to swim. And she's trying to figure out, how am I going to get into this country? Now, here's what's crazy. Let's say she gets across, she gets into the country. Here's your reward. Great, you got in. You still don't speak the language. You still don't have money. You still don't have a job. You still don't have a place to stay. But hey, you got in. Guys, on my worst day of being sexually molested by one of my dad's prostitutes, being in and out of juvenile prison three different times, being abandoned when I was 12 years old, homeless when I was 13, eating out of trash cans, on my worst day, I never had to walk 1,100 miles and try to get into this country. I was born
here. Speaking a different language, knowing nothing, and then trying to make it, right?
Yep. So on my worst day, man, I'm like, hey, I was born here. I have a responsibility to be successful, regardless of the fact that my dad was a pimp and had 23 kids and I'm mixed race and my mom was an orphan. I'll take my childhood five more times if you tell me I get to have the life I have right now.
Man, I had six kids. Seeing, your dad's got 23. People would call me a quitter then. I don't have six kids.
Well, but even knowing folks that, you know, parents did exactly what you just described and are now, you know, having successful careers one generation removed from what their parents, you know, it's just, I don't know. There's some amazing things also happening. So guys, let's take a quick time out to hear from our sponsor.
Get involved in multifamily, this is where you need to be.
The team you've built is incredible.
There is no egos here. Everyone is always looking to help the other person.
All right, we're back. You know, unique show for us. We kind of keep it to people, profits, and process, or whatever Siobhan said a minute ago, but we're going deep. We're having the conversations, but we're going to dive in a little bit to some things that you have going on from a personal growth perspective. We had, you know, talked about a great transformation that you personally had, you know, losing some weight and some things like that. So why don't you tell us a little, what are you doing right now for the diet? You know, talk about the fitness and some of the cool things you have going on personally.
Oh man. So yeah, it's I'm 51 now. I turned 51 back on September 25th.
You're looking D's right now.
Yeah, I appreciate it, man. Yeah. I'm in the gym each day. I get up every day, 3:30, 3:45. I go sit on the couch first thing, say my prayers. I'm in the gym by 4:30. And you know, 5-6 days a week. And I'm real consistent. You know, I got five pillars in life: God, health, family, business, and investing. If it doesn't fall in those five, I don't do it. You're never going to hear about me spending 3 hours on social media each day. That's like literally, that's the average of how long people spend on social media each day. I focus on the things that are important to me. So from a personal perspective, man, my youngest is 3 years old. So I got to be around for a while. So it's, you know, I've lost, man, close to 40 something pounds. I'm down to 208.
How long did that take? That's incredible. I don't know. Was it 2 years ago, last time we spoke, or?
Yeah, it was a while back. It took, man, my mother passed away in March of this year of stage 4 Parkinson's. And I had got back up to about 260, man. I just went on an eating spree.
Feels good.
Man, it was, well, and you know, the big thing for me, man, was I don't have a family background. You know, my mom was raised in an orphanage. She has no family. And, you know, I only got her last name because when she went into labor, she had to walk herself to the hospital. My dad was nowhere to be found. So my mom literally had nothing in this world. So she said, okay, I've got this child now. I'm going to give him my last name. So it was definitely an emotional roller coaster when the person who gave me this last name passed away, especially for the reasons why she gave me the last name. And more importantly, she gave me a last name that we don't even know where it comes from. So there was a lot of emotional going on with that. Man, I just went on an eating spree. Got up to about 260 mid-April. Late April. And then from there, I'm like, okay, I gotta pull it back. And I got down to about 208 come mid-August.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's the diet like right now?
I eliminate all sugar and wheat. So I'll eat fish, chicken, steak, protein drinks, protein bars. I'll
tough to find good protein bars without the sugar, man. That's not easy.
I know, man. It's a beast, but a lot of protein drinks. I'll eat eggs. I don't eat a lot of fat, but I'll eat olive oil, avocado oil with my rice and steak or my fish. But I like it, man. I like how I feel. If I go and splurge, I can immediately feel the difference in my thought process, my body, how I feel. So I enjoy the way I feel right now. So I like to keep the party going.
You're lifting how many days a week?
Four or five, man. I'll do a chest on one day, back on one day, arms on one day, shoulders. And in between there, I'll do legs. And then I'll do calves and abs on one day.
I struggle with more than 3 days a week anymore.
You know, I love it.
I love it.
I struggle not to go seven.
Yeah. I'm doing five, but 2 days are like more like intense cardio. And I don't want to call it cardio. It's like sprints and like biking hills and things. And then other like 3 days of weights. And it's just, my body responds better. I just recently, like a few, 2 months ago or whatever, I was hitting 5 days a week. And I felt like I was breaking down too much. And so, everyone's a little different, right? So
it is, man. I got to work out with David Goggins and...
Did he call you a bitch and effing this and that or what?
Man, so I've worked out with him twice.
He didn't actually physically hurt you, did he? Doesn't like start punching you if you don't do it?
No. So what was crazy though, man? So I worked out with him the first time, and I actually completed the workout with him. And what was it?
A run or lift?
It was a lift.
I don't want to run with that dude.
And I told him that too. I said, look, man, I will lift with you, but I am not running. That's not my thing. So we went to the gym, we worked out, and it was brutal. And so we worked out for an hour and a half. Then we took a half hour break and went and had egg whites, went and had breakfast. And then we went and did two back-to-back 45-minute soul cycle sessions. We were staying at the Wynn.
It sounds miserable.
Oh, my God. And so, but I finished. And so he tells me afterwards, he goes, man, I got to admit, I'm kind of impressed. I thought you'd quit I didn't think you'd finish. And I'm like, man, hey.
Well, because he's got to be like 160 or something, right? And I mean,
he's about 180. Yeah, I think about 180.
That's still like you're carrying a lot more than him.
Oh,
right?
Man, I told him, I said, look, here's how this was going down. I was going to die or you were going to call EMS or like, but I wasn't quitting. And so then I went back and worked out with him again. And I think he was like, oh, okay. That's what you think, man. We did some shit called 5 and 10s. You do five pull-ups and then you do 10 push-ups. So we're rotating.
I love that.
While I'm doing my push-ups, he's doing his pull-ups, and we rotate. You go 45 minutes straight, no break, no water.
Dude, I'll give you 10 minutes.
Yeah. I gave you 6 minutes.
Oh, my God. So we finish doing that, and he says, okay, take a minute break. And then we do weighted walking lunges. And I'm like, what the f- is this? Then we, I'm thinking, okay, we're winding down. He said, all right, let's go knock out some abs. What the hell's going on? And I was like, okay, I see what he's doing. He's literally going to try to break me on this.
He was trying to break you for sure.
Yeah. So we finish, we go have breakfast again. And he says, okay, we're going to go back and do cardio. And so I'm like, okay. I'm like, what are we going to do? And so we walk over and there's this elliptical machine and the Stairmaster right next to each other. And I'm like, oh, okay, I do these each time. Oh, I'm good. Like, we're going to knock this out. And he says, okay, here's what we're going to do. You're going to start on the
that
elliptical.
That does not start off well for
you. Yeah, here's what we're going to do. He said, you're going to start on the elliptical. I'm going to start on Stairmaster. And he said, okay, you're going to start at level 50. And immediately I'm looking, I'm like, I didn't even know this shit went to 11.
I were like a four, bro. Come on.
And so out of curiosity, I'm like, okay, he said, start at 11:50. He said, yeah. So once you get to 5 minutes, you're going to go to 100. I was like, oh my God. And he said, you're going to go 20, I'm going to go 20 on the Stairmaster. Then we're going to switch. So we both finish our go, and you can't use your hands, no hands. And so we finish and then we have to switch.
Dude, have you fallen off that thing?
Oh my God. Oh, this isn't the best. I'm going to give you the best part of it. So we switch. He says, okay, get on the Stairmaster now. And you're going to go level 11 for 20 minutes. No hands. Oh my God. So then we finish again. He goes, now let's switch again. We're going to go 15 minutes each. So it was 2015 on elliptical, 2015 on the Stairmaster. We finish all that. And he says, okay, take a minute break. And while he's telling me to take a minute break, he's allowing me to sit down. He's standing there looking at me, like waiting, like, come on. He says, okay, now we're going to do jumping jacks. So I'm thinking, okay, I'm good. I can do jumping jacks. We start going and we get to about 35 and he yells out, he goes, man, you got some great fucking form. I like it. Keep it going. So now I'm feeling good. I'm like, you're damn right. I do. What's up? And then, so we get to 75 and I'm like, okay, we get to 100. Okay. He's like, keep it going. And I'm like, what the hell's going on? 125, I take a break and I lean over and he's like, come on, man, we got 50 more. I'm like, oh my God, what is going on? So we finish and he says, okay, drop down. Let's do some more abs. And yeah, that was the work, man.
You kept going through the whole thing?
I kept going through the whole thing, man.
Was he yelling at you doing the David Goggins thing at all or no?
No, he.
Oh
he,
man, that's like he, only like half the experience then.
You know the reason why he wasn't, we were in the wind, and it kind of sucked too, man. I won't bullshit, man. Part of what kept me going as well, there were a lot of people in the gym and looking recognized.
Well, and you're working out with David Goggins, so you got to hang. You can't not hang in that situation. You got to go or get dragged off.
And I'm
like
watching
said.
People film, and I'm like, I am not going to be the busted ass guy on Instagram.
You would have been though. That shit goes viral too. Like David Goggins just murdered another soul, right?
So yeah, man, it was that. That was some different shit. But yeah,
I almost feel bad for him though because he's created such a persona around being that guy that every time he has a workout buddy, he's got to bury them.
I said this to him, and he actually he said, you know what, man, I appreciate that. No one's ever said it that way. I said, you do not train to work out with David Goggins. You either work out with him and learn how to do it, and you got to be consistent, or you just get, there's no preparing for his workout. Yeah. Nothing. You cannot prepare for it. There's no training to get ready for
it. How old is he?
47, 48.
How the hell is he still doing it, dude?
Oh man.
Like Tom Brady ain't doing that workout. I'm just telling you right now, like,
It's
incredible his body's held up. That's the thing I just can't get. Like the running alone is just insane, man.
Yeah, the running's a beast.
Yeah, on the knees. All right, we've just been going all over the place. give us the hub here for Scribe, and you know where folks can find out more about you because we want to make sure we get that out there before we wrap up here.
So, man, I mean, scribemedia.com, you can find me. I'm mainly on LinkedIn. That's about the only platform that I particularly care for. So you can find me on LinkedIn. Now they're starting to put like videos of me. I share a lot of my mistakes throughout my career. Things
I hope
I
you put the Goggins video up. I'll check that out.
Hell no.
he's like, my form was great until you see the video.
Now, what was cool, I have to admit, you know, he did the foreword to my new book. And so considering that my book is on leadership, you know, for him to have done the foreword, I really
That's
appreciate
a solid it. Forward.
Yeah, man. Yeah. And so I really, really appreciated the fact that he did the foreword for me. And John Mackey wrote one of the blurbs. The former CEO of Chipotle did one of the blurbs. James Altucher did one of the blurbs. That was pretty cool. So, I'm very proud of the book for what it stands for and that people can really see that there's a better way to do business in serving people. But also that, you know, people and profits don't have to be against each other. They don't have to be mutually exclusive. You know, they can live together. So
have you read Small Giants?
I have. Yeah.
You know, I was getting a Small Giants vibe because it's one of our favorite books. And, you know, just like a quick thing, like so obviously we have multifamily real estate and our team members actually at a 2-year mark have the ability to invest into our deals. So, you know, not, you know, completely traditional, but we're actually, it's going to be a team member owned, you know, company over time, and that continues to grow. And we're huge fans of Small Giants, obviously very much enjoy, you know, everything that you're saying. So I was like, I was getting Small Giant vibes there, and I just wanted to throw that out there for you.
Yeah, I actually, it's funny you said that. I actually spoke at the Small Giants conference back in Detroit a few years ago. Yeah.
I could feel the connection, man.
Totally. So totally.
All right, Gino, it's up to you, man. You take us home and you nail this. Otherwise, it's a complete flop. No pressure.
You're killing me, Brosif. Well, you have JT, Javon McCormick, born in 1971 in Dayton, Ohio.
There we go.
A black father and a white mother. And he's got a few tough years. I mean, he's driving around with his dad, and that's this first taste of entrepreneurship where somebody's rolling down a window and getting a big wad of cash, and he sees how his dad treats his team members. And as his evolution continues, becoming homeless, going to these amazing neighborhoods and seeing what the possibility is, and pulling himself, extricating himself out from that situation, and being able to become, I guess, one of the top executives in all of Austin, and winning all these awards and accolades. But I think his driving force and his impact that he wants to lead and leave to his legacy, to his children as well, is working hard, but also making profits count, making money matter. And it's all about people, process, and profits. And what do you do with those profits? It's great that we're all privileged here, but privilege can be taken two ways. You can be taken as being selfish and worrying about yourself, or you can look from within yourself and go outward and trying to help others. And I think that's been the mission of Scribe, to help people put their words and their stories on paper and books and be able to share their stories with others. And to me, it's an amazing story of someone who could have just sat back and said, well, I had this situation happen to me. It's not what happens to you. It's, you know, what ultimately you come out of that. We're all dealt certain cards, certain situations. What you do and how you react to that defines you as a man. And it's been an honor and a privilege to have JT on the show. His name is Javon. I like Javon much better. Thank God.
And I appreciate that.
It's been a great show. I've really enjoyed the show tremendously. And it's great to actually sit here and have a conversation and be able to debate and discuss and to look at someone else's viewpoints and maybe not agree, but maybe also say to yourself, hey, that made sense. Let me think about that more often. That's what writing a book and sharing ideas should be all about.
You nailed it, man. That's where we are as a country. We all need to listen, learn, and seek to understand. We don't have to agree with one another. We don't have to all, you know, we're not all Methodist. We're not all Lutheran. We're not all Muslim. And that's okay. You know, I'm a God guy. My kids go to private Christian school, but hey, do I feel that gays should be allowed to get married? Man, it's hard enough to find one person to love in this world. So if you want to get married, do your thing, man. And mm-hmm. Because here's the thing, at the end of the day, whatever we believe in, abortion, no abortion, whatever, one, you have to make peace with yourself. Two, you have to make peace with whatever higher power you believe in. But it's not for us to humans to judge and pull someone else down and tell them they're wrong. It is everyone's, in my opinion, doing their life the way they want to do their life. And it's not up to me to tell you how you should do that.
Javon, I'm going to summarize it right here. Exposure to what's possible. That's what you do for those kids, and that's what you're promoting. I think that's fantastic. Really appreciate your time today. Gang, as always, we believe in buying deals for the long term, thinking decades. I'm Jake. He's the G-Daddy. We make it happen. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, Javon.
Thanks, guys.